And welcome again to Food Conversations Season 5. Before we begin, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this ongoing situation is a responsibility for us all. Today, we're delighted to once again welcome Jamie Smith back to our studio. Jamie is the co-owner of Marionette Winery, which produces handcrafted small batches of 5 different wine varietals, as well as welcoming guests into this part of the country to enjoy the wine that he has carefully prepared. Jamie has traveled far, traveled to England and continental Europe, and trained in the craft of winemaking and associated skills, and brought this expertise to bear for Marionette Winery with his business partner, Amanda Eastwood, where they create these wonderful small batches of wine from 5 different varietals for the delectation of wine aficionados throughout BC. Jamie, welcome back to Food Conversations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back again. It's great to be back.
It's going to be an enjoyable program today because we're going to talk about how you make wine. Now, I think a lot of people have some understanding of that, but when it comes to the details and the subtleties of actually making it for the public at large, it's a whole different process. Now, by the way, when I say throughout BC, selling it throughout BC, you have outlets all over the place that are carrying your wine. I counted up 35 in the Lower Mainland, 19 in the Okanagan, 18 outlets in the North Okanagan and Shuswap, and 13 on Vancouver Island. Now, how do you get your wine all over the province like that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's an ongoing, very dynamic process in itself. It's always changing. I remember when studying wine production, Amanda and I both studied together, and we took a class in wine business, just in case we had to be on this side of things. And the professor, I remember, said something that I've always remembered, where he said, you know, we always get students coming back saying, I'm making this great wine, but the problem is, how do I sell it? Like, how do I get rid of it? Like, I just thought I'd make wine and it would just be bought.
It would magically evaporate out of the universe.
And it's funny, like being a winemaker or working in the vineyard, you never see that side of things. But then when you're on that side of things, you do realize that it's something that I feel like I spend maybe 10% of my time nowadays making wine, and the rest of it is trying to get it out there and get people to experience it. And actually, you know, I mean, I quite like that part of it too. I'm glad that there's, I mean, it's sales and getting wine out there is like 90% rejection, no matter how good your wine is, but it's fun. Like, it's fun to meet people and talk to people. And
is that an issue where once it's known, it's okay, but until it's known, you have to persuade people that there's something that they should enjoy if they were to buy it?
Well, I think there's some disadvantages in our province, the way that people look at wine. Unfortunately, Vancouver and Kelowna have this idea that wines are only made in Naramata or Similkameen or like around Kelowna. And I feel like if you've got like $20 million in pocket and you start a winery in Naramata, then, you know, like Vancouver will just open their arms to you and be like, oh yeah, absolutely. Like, well, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, what your wine is, we'll carry it. Whereas when you go down there and you say you're from what they call an emerging region, you don't get that. You get skepticism, and then you, like, when they taste it, they're like, yeah, this is great, you know. But
it's bridging that gap.
Yeah, and I feel like I can't wait for that to be. I want more wineries to set up here, you know what I mean? Like, I'm a big believer in this region and where we are and you know, all the, you know, like, we, I think, historically produced our fair share of fruit here, you know, and I think that it's just a matter of time, but I do hope that it sort of expands that way, that, you know, that there's more producers here.
How many wineries, small-scale wineries, are there sort of in the immediate surround, in the what you'd call the Shuswap? Or the
in the Shuswap sort of valley. Well, I know that there's like there's us, Sunny Bray, Recline Ridge, Ovino, Solista, although Solista's a bit of a stretch, but it's definitely like in our area because it's, you know, it's like in the Shuswap area. And then, although I shouldn't say that, Solista is like, it's just, I think of it that way because it's a longer drive, but it's really,
it's in the same,
definitely part of
it's
our,
it's the same biogeoclimatic
zone.
Yeah,
exactly. Roughly. And it, like, it's definitely in our sort of area. And Larch Hills, of course, the first winery that was here. And I hope I'm not missing. Oh, and like I always, you know, I always think of Waterside being part of our area too. And Edge of the Earth. I'm really hoping I'm not missing somebody because I feel
well,
so bad. But
I think
we are quite spread apart. That's the problem. Like I think we'll always be this area, but we could. There's a lot of area to fill in. You know what I mean? Like
sure.
We could have a lot more wineries.
And it's also an area where people can grow it. It's not a hard area to adapt to, and you get the right varietals.
Yeah, and that's what really bothers me is when you go down to like. Not so much Vancouver, but when you go down to like the Okanagan, people will be like, "Wow, you can grow grapes there," and it's it's this funny idea that people have that it's like that we're somehow trying to grow grapes
in
like
snow
Williams
region.
Lake or something, or you know what I mean? Like it's
the Arctic Circle.
It's a strange perception they have of really how close we are to them.
I just had a subversive thought. What if somebody inside the Arctic Circle had a greenhouse and they grew some grapes there and they produced wine from north
people have experimented with that. The problem is that it's the amount of sunlight you get. Like we are, I mean, I guess that is a fair argument. Like we are on the edge of that. It doesn't matter how, like, you know, when it doesn't matter how much things change climatically, although
it is getting warmer, and that makes the zone is growing bigger.
It is getting warmer. It's also getting more extreme cold. So, but
yes.
but I think even then, I don't think it would make much of a difference if you got to a certain latitude, just because you wouldn't have the growing degree days. You know what I mean? Like it.
Sure.
Although I guess if it got a lot warmer, it wouldn't matter because you'd have longer days and they but it really is the vines need a certain amount of frost-free days and heat accumulation to produce ripe grapes and that's I mean like you know there are these university produced like grapes that have been engineered, I guess, not genetically engineered, not necessarily,
but especially
but
bred.
Crossed, yeah, to produce grapes in like Saskatchewan and stuff, and that is a very fascinating element of modern sort of science, but they aren't like from what I've seen, what I know, and arguably, like I'm not like an expert in that, but I haven't seen grapes. From those programs that produce wine that equals the thousands of years of cultivation that have produced a grape like, for example, Pinot Noir or Cabernet Sauvignon, like it's just it just takes time and you know.
So let's allow that the growing field of small scale wine making and viticulture is going to expand because I think it is expanding. We certainly see it in this area, and I've been here for over 40 years and seen go from zero to what we have now, and I see expanding as well. But today we need to talk about making wine.
Yeah,
and you do have some real expertise, the practical expertise that can only come from actually doing it as well as being trained in it. So an in-depth conversation about winemaking will, I think, be of great interest to many of our listeners, especially the way you're doing it, which involves an intimate relationship with the land. I mean, it's all winemaking does, but when you do it the way you do it, it's particularly true. Sensitivity, of course, to weather, climate, as well as a sensitivity to the health of the grapevines and to the ecosystem that surrounds them. And that brings up a word that we've used in our discussions, and that's the word terroir. It's a French word, and it's related to la terre, which means the land, but it's beyond that. It's a sort of a landscape-based concept. Why don't you talk about what terroir is and why it's important for you here?
Yeah, well, I guess, first of all, it's one of those words that's almost impossible to translate into English. When I've heard people use it, there's a lot of sort of history and culture there. And you can sort of see it on, if you buy a bottle of French wine that's under the QWPSR sort of scheme, the quality wine producing scheme, the appellation system, as they call it, then you'll notice that they don't have the varietals on the label. They name them after villages, or they name them after, like, if it's a very...
It's very localized.
Yeah, and that's the basis of the system there, where they basically, they define wine more on the, like, the style of the village that produced it. And, you know, you sort of see that with things like cheese production and bread, like even breads, can be like traditionally from a certain place, right? Mm. Like, I don't know where, like, you know, like everyone that makes like croissants, for example, like has a certain starter that they've had for, like, you know, hundreds of years or for generations.
And this is kind of the opposite of the mass-produced industrial production model.
Yeah, we don't get that here. Like, I remember there was a documentary, I wish I could remember it, but it was really, really good, and it was about 10 years ago, or maybe 11, 12 years ago that it came out, and it was really, like, about what they call, like, the new world and old world wine production, okay? And there's a big difference. Like, the old world would be places like what we know best as France, but also Austria, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and...
Germany.
And there's a lot of culture and ways of thinking about wine that have always been there and have developed over, like, through wars, through dynasties of religious institutions, things like that.
Well, wine does have a very long history in those parts of the world you were talking about. And by the way, listeners, just remind you that I'm speaking with Jamie Smith, who is the co-owner of Marionette Wineries, and going to explain all the intricacies of wine growing today. It goes back 8,000 years to the country of Georgia, between next to the Caspian Sea. There is evidence there of winemaking activities that are carried on to this day. There are still artisanal wineries, and the landscape is littered with vineyards that grow special varieties that are adapted to their terroir and their culture as well. One of the interesting things that I found out was the earliest winemaking process involved putting clay vats, I would call them pots, but they're very big, up to 100,000 liters sometimes, which is pretty big, but averaging about 800 liters, in the ground, buried in the ground, just barely visible above the ground. And the clay that they make these pots out has an enormous influence on the wine, because the minerals in the pots are absorbed into the wine and create nuances in the flavor and the consistency. Hmm. So it goes back a long way. These big earthenware pots are called kvevri. That's me speaking in the Georgian dialect, which nobody at this room can contradict at this point. But they've clearly, and they're still doing it today, the same technology is being used today. Mm. So there's a lot of background to winemaking. It's not just something that sprang out of the ground a little while ago. Much of the winemaking, as you said, on this side of the Atlantic has derived its roots from that side of the Atlantic, but obviously takes on its own nuances because of this terroir, this capacity of the land and the culture together to produce something. Now, you've got five varietals you obtained from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Why don't you just outline me? I'll name them, and then you can tell me and the listeners what they represent, what kind of qualities they have. So Grüner Veltliner.
Yeah, so Grüner is an Austrian grape, and it's been around a long time. Austrian grape varieties have been around a long time, and they don't have the cultural weight that French varieties do here. But obviously in Austria, they are they are basically the center of their
beverage
wine industry.
Of choice.
Yeah. and Austrian wine is just like French wine, just like Italian wine. It's been through the same historical, cultural story as I mean, I always think it's funny that we're sort of obsessed with French wine. Like I guess historically that's because of the French relationship with the British Empire and this idea coming from like Louis XIV and his dynasty and legacy of French sort of having more cultural the culture that came out of that was very powerful.
Plus Canada's second official language is French.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a connection there. And in Quebec, wines are taken very seriously. If you use the wrong appellation, you can get a fine. Whereas here, people don't even notice. So you've responded to that by having three Chardonnay, Pinot Blanc and Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm. So, and Pinot Gris too, actually. Yeah.
Well, there we are. So you've adapted that as well by bringing some of these well-known French varietals into the culture here.
Yeah.
But they're also suitable for the terroir.
Well, yeah, and I think that's what it comes down to, is that when you're looking at what grapes to plant, it does quite often. I mean, France and northern France and Austria have the closest similarity, and in terms of Burgundy, very close similarity to where we are up on North Brabant there. And in terms of growing degree days and frost-free days, we're very similar to Côte de Nuit, and where Pinot Noir is from. And so I think that for us, you know, if you're going to look for varieties that have, A, been cultivated the longest, you almost can't look further than Pinot Noir, and unless you were looking at grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon, you know what I mean? Yeah.
You did round out your varietals, however, with another Austrian called Zweigelt.
Yeah,
and you've described it in on your website as, again, a relatively undiscovered varietal outside of its homeland, dark notes of black cherry and spice, and it's a good cool climate grape, so it would have some capacity to deal with the climate that we have here.
Yeah, I love that grape. I think, for me, that grape is the biggest thrill, because it's a little bit like fuller bodied than, well, it's quite a bit more fuller bodied than Pinot Noir. And people always think, I think, again, going back to like the French like schematica, right, you think northern French, like cool climate reds are light and they're not really like, they don't pack a punch, but they've got great flavors. That's what sort of Pinot Noir is. And then if you really want like the heavy reds, you got to go down to like southern France and Spain. And that's true, except that if you go further east in Europe, and, you know, arguably like the Iron Curtain separated us from those wine cultures for, you know, a couple generations. So like if you were talking to somebody in like 1910 about great red wines, they might talk to you about a wine from Hungary called Bull's Blood. You know what I mean? Like that, and that wine still exists. I mean, it's a very, very heavy red made in Hungary. And it used to be that the center of Europe really was like around Prague. Like Prague was like Paris, you know what I mean? Like it got separated from us, and it hasn't really, like, you know, Prague is obviously has been like a big mecca for tourism and culture and stuff since the 90s, but it hasn't reclaimed that spot yet. But
very, you know, sophisticated city.
Yeah, countries like Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic, they will, I'm sure, become again, you know what I mean, like the center of Europe as they were. But it's interesting to me that the all those varieties of great, all those great varieties, like they have yet to sort of come back into the zeitgeist, you know.
It's interesting you mentioned Hungarian wine, bull's blood.
Yeah.
The notion of red wine representing blood, which is part of the Christian tradition, actually was part of the ancient Egyptian concept of wine. In ancient Egypt, red wine was construed to be a metaphor or symbol of blood, and other kinds of wines were used a lot in religious ceremonials, which have become global in their spread. So there's a kind of global element to wine as part of sacred and sacral.
Yeah, absolutely. The cult of Dionysus is
indeed
what I always think of as the sort of beginning of our idea of what wine is, that sort of the joy of life, you know what I mean? That you get from, like, the cliche sort of you get from, like, French wine culture is really a derivation of, like, the cult of Dionysus, you know,
indeed,
or at least an element of it, you know what I mean? Like,
and then the Romans followed up with their bacchanalias, which also involved, and Bacchus is the goddess, of
who
wine.
Who was largely borrowed from Dionysus, right?
Absolutely. People steal shamelessly.
Cultural transmission.
Yes, exactly. That's a much better term than stealing, because actually where it goes is also a place where it's much appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remind listeners again that I'm talking with Jamie Smith, an expert wine grower from the Shoe Swap and co-owner of Marionette Wineries. So let's just, for people's interest, talk about the different kinds of wine, because there's a number. You have red and white and rosé.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three.
And some fortified.
And some fortified, which we'll talk about how you get that as well. Then there's sparkling wine, which people may know as primarily as champagne.
Yeah.
A different kind of wine. Is it much grown in this part of the world?
Well, it's coming on more and more. The problem with sparkling wine, and actually Amanda, my partner, the other winemaker at Marionette, is really keen to start some sparkling wine at Marionette. But the problem with it is that it's, like, to do it in a modern way, you need this really expensive equipment, and it's hard to sort of do. It's like the wine that we were going to probably try to do is a very rustic version of how champagne used to be made, a method called the ancestral method, where you're basically turning the bottles by hand and stuff. And we wouldn't be able to do like a lot of it because we don't have a lot of space for storage. The other thing is storage, and it's the ultimate, like, put this wine away for 2 years and don't make any money off of it until you release it. if you do it that way,
it's hard to do in a small scale operation.
And it ties up a lot of capital. It is sort of like the Scotch version of wine. If you do it in a way that is like the best results really come from not putting it in a big vat and carbonating it, you know what I mean? Like a Charmat sort of tank. The best result is when every bottle is re-fermented, like, you know, in bottle with the new yeast. Like you do your base wine and then you add yeast again and you crown cap the champagne bottles. And champagne bottles, like the heavy, heavy bottles, are built to withstand like six bar
atmospheres.
Yeah. So everything happens inside that bottle, and you keep turning it until the yeast are in the neck, and then you can disgorge and put the cork on right away, right? And that's a real skill, like doing all of that. And it's a fascinating wine. But we haven't geared ourselves up for that yet.
I think your customers will be very happy with the red, white.
They might get a few bottles at the beginning with half of the bottle gone because of our poor disgorging.
Preparing for the show, I was reading about so many of the early attempts to make sparkling wine. People had to wear special protective gear when they went into the storage area because they didn't know when the bottle was going to blow up.
And
fragments of glass flying all over the place. Not a pleasant thing.
Six bar is a lot of pressure.
Yeah, six atmospheric pressures. Ice wine. It's a bit of a specialty wine. Not everybody grows it. I know there isn't a huge amount of interest in this part of the world, but what's the characteristic? How do you get ice wine?
So ice wine is our grapes that are left on the vine. I think that it happens more often in places that have a colder, like quicker onset to winter. You know what I mean? Where the grapes can still be on the vine.
And they have to freeze.
-10 degrees, yeah. And they have to be picked at that temperature and then pressed at that temperature. And you're basically pressing a concentrate, because the ice crystals that you see on the outside of a grape when it's frozen, that used to be water inside the grape. So when it freezes, basically ice, like when it crystallizes and basically shreds the grape and comes out of the grape. So when you press the grape, you're essentially pressing like a frozen raisin. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
But it's the difference is that it hasn't oxidized. So if you're quick and you press, then you get all those amazing tropical fruit flavors because it hasn't turned to like date raisin sort of flavors. But it's a
very
hard
complicated
process.
Yeah. I'm getting tired just hearing you. Listen.
Yeah, and they have to do it at -10 every, like all the way. It's like 4 in the morning and stuff. So
dear me.
It's not something I'd be happy to do.
So we'll end up with a little conversation, a little discussion of fortified wines and dessert wines.
Yeah, so we make a dessert wine that's a fortified wine. It's based on we make a white and a red that's based on Vin du Naturel from southern France, which is sort of like. You know, there's lots of fortified styles that develop in their own right in Europe, like port. Everybody knows port, but there's quite a few other examples of that. And sherry, yeah, sherry is a completely different system again, which involves oxidizing on purpose the wine using a fungus, like. Again, all of these wines, like port and sherry, I think they developed sort of accidentally.
By mistake.
Yeah. That's my theory. Anyway, like sherry is a very interesting wine, but we it's really specific to where it's made in Cádiz, the province of Cádiz.
And Spain. They made the mistake, so they get to correct it.
Well, and they've got this they've got this fungus or yeast, basically. Or mold that sit like they have this half filled barrel, and then they realize that there was this one species of yeast that basically would grow on the surface. They call it the floor, and it would grow on the surface of the wine in the barrel, and it would actually like sort of oxidize the wine, but in a really beneficial way, and it gives all those sort of nutty flavors. So they kept that yeast going. Like they've got some that are like back, like they're like a couple hundred years old. You know what I mean? Like they call them the mother. Well, it's sort of a bit like kombucha, I guess. You know what
sure.
I mean? Like you can keep it going forever and ever. Like, but anyway, yeah. Our fortifieds are based on more the port style, where you harvest the grapes and you start the fermentation exactly like you would normally, and then halfway through you put basically pure alcohol, or as close as pure alcohol as you can get, about 10% to the volume of your tank. So if you had 100 liters of wine, you'd put like 10 liters of that in, of the alcohol. That kills the yeast, stops the fermentation, and gives you, like, sort of preserves the flavors and the sweetness. So you, as a winemaker, again, it's one of those wines where you decide how it's going to be, right?
Well, obviously, as we're talking about these fortified wines, it's clear that many of them occurred in particular places because of particular circumstances. And we can leave them there because we have a lot to talk about with respect to growing wine here in the Sioux Swap,
right, yeah.
Which you have done very successfully at Marionette Wines. So let's do a sort of once over through the wine growing process. The first step, obviously, is finding the right varietals and
right.
planting them.
Yeah.
You have to put them in the ground. So you had a landscape that did not have grape vines growing in it, and you had some varietals you knew would work in this area.
Mm-hmm.
What about planting them? What special things do you have to think about as you lay out the rows of vines?
So Well, before that, I think you have to, like, when you're deciding on what varieties, we looked at the climate or the weather data for the station out on the lake there.
Sure.
For the last 25 years, back to like 1981. And then there was also another weather station that transmitted for a long time out of the airport. And we sort of used that data to give us like over 20 years. Although you can see like the uptick of like it's, you know, getting warmer. Like it's interesting. You could see that sort of
that trend taking place.
Yeah. But at any rate, we sort of took that and then researched specific varieties. We already sort of knew where we'd be getting them from, but we just sort of more confirmed that the varieties that we wanted to do that we thought would work here were within that sort of growing degree days. And growing degree days are a system of sort of figuring out heat accumulation. So, for example, you basically take like a day, and let's say it's like it got up to 25 degrees and the low was like 10 degrees. You'd sort of take the average of that, and then there's like a base point temperature of like for grapevines, it's like 10 degrees. And then you...
And these are ideas that are very old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there's also like, because that was all based on like a certain latitude, they've actually changed that a bit. And because they realize that it like the altitude or latitude, sorry, that we are at, that you actually get longer days in the summer. So the growing degree day like calculation didn't take that into account, because we actually get a lot, like we're still accumulating heat like at 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, you know what I mean, in the middle of summer. So that sort of explains why like it works, like we can grow for some varieties here that.
So you're looking at the quality of the environment above the ground, but you're also looking at the quality of the soil itself.
Now you have soil is the most important thing, I think, apart from like the actual having the growing degree days and the
and you tested the soil to find out what kind of soil you had. What did you find?
Yeah, so the whole North Broadview soil like situation is that it's a very healthy, very complex and mineral rich soil, and it's I think more than anything else I am like really excited about that element of in terms of a sense of place or a sense of terroir, in terms of the flavors and the qualities we get in the wine. I think that it's not just North Broadview, but like where Sunny Bray is too, you know what I mean? And I'm sure like Larch, I only know about where we are, but like I've talked to James from Sunny Bray and I know that like they've got a very similar, like they've got very good soils there too. But I think that the complexity, it's about complexity. I think that more than sand and gravel, which everybody talks about in the Okanagan, I think that if you get sort of like a mineral-rich soil, you have much more depth and complexity in the wine.
And you also pointed out before the show that you don't have any spikes. You don't have any excess deposits of particular minerals in the soil that would move it in one direction or another away from this kind of balance you're
talking
about.
No, it's very balanced. There's no like antagonisms towards magnesium, like between magnesium and calcium, and there's nothing we have to like
amend for.
So it's just, you know, as it is, it's just a perfect soil for grapes, you know what I mean? I think
listeners, pay attention. It's a perfect soil growing grapes. Now you grow the grapes, they're planted in rows. Does anybody plant grapes in any other configuration than in rows?
There are like different traditional ways of doing it, like the gobelet style, where it's just a bush in you could see that in places that are like in Rioja and Spain and stuff. And I think where it's extremely hot, that style actually allows for more like vine survival. But generally speaking, the trellis system is king, you know what I mean?
You've also made a point of maintaining some of the natural attributes of the vegetation on your property.
That's super important to us,
specifically avoiding using pesticides and fertilizers amendments.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't need fertilizers because of the the soil, which is great. But we do actually, we do things like we plant clover to keep the nitrogen like at a certain level. The clover has a symbiotic relationship with mycorrhizae, fungus, and they fix nitrogen. So it's a great way to like keep nitrogen in the soil. I mean, but apart from that, like that's something that fits into like natural farming, and you know, it's a way of basically keeping the soil going, right?
I was looking up all the pests that can land on your grapes, and I realized that most of them were funguses. There's a few bacterial. Yeah. That's because of the sugar, right? That's because of the...
Actually, the fungus problem.
When you're baking bread,
is,
you put a little sugar in your mix to make the yeast grow.
I mean, I think the problem with grape vines is that they are native to, like you said, they came from the Black Sea area, and then they were all through Europe, and they didn't have any exposure to powdery mildew or phylloxera, the aphid that eats the roots. All of those things were brought over at one point by people going back and forth from like North America in like the Victorian age, and these the exposure, like, I mean, it was inevitable, I guess, the moment you had transporting live sort of plant material, you would have these, like, it's really, it was devastating to the Vitis vinifera vines in Europe. And since then, now that they're all over the globe, there is no, like, natural immunity to powdery mildew. So people, like, who want to spray non-toxic sort of chemicals to combat this fungus, because if you didn't do anything, you would lose all of your grapes. Like powdery mildew would decimate, and then botrytis after that, like later on in the season when the grapes are sweet, because powdery actually attacks the grapes from the moment they, like, moment there's bud burst. Basically, you have powdery, you have to start spraying the moment you have a rain event. But powdery basically will attack the grapes when long before they're sweet, like and then botrytis comes in at the end and takes that damage and destroys the grapes, right? But the thing is, those sorts of viral fungal diseases of grapes, there are ways, things you can spray that are actually really like, they're non-toxic.
They're accepted as organic, part of the organic.
That's the one thing that we spray that everybody has to spray is some sort of, and you have a choice. I mean, you can spray the more sort of non-toxic fungicides, or and how much you spray is really important too. Like I was talking to somebody that was saying that it isn't like you can just spray as much fungicide as you want either, because if you want to keep those, the soil fungus is obviously super important, and we all know that now from like the research that's come out that shows that trees sort of talk to each other
indeed
in forests using fungus,
the hyphae, the long little branches,
the mycelium and all of that, that relationship, like, and grapevines do that too. They share, you know, they share, it's like a transport network of minerals, and it's super important. So you have to be careful of how much fungicide you spray, because eventually if you were spraying like just tons of it to like, you know, belt and braces, whatever that expression is, you'd be basically impacting the fungus in the soil, and that would be ultimately devastating as well.
Let's assume this year that the non-beneficial fungus population has been kept at bay. You have at some point a crop of grapes that is smiling at you from the rows of vines that you planted. Harvesting. What's the process of harvesting? What are the key elements of the harvesting process?
So it depends. Whites and reds come out. Here in where we are, it's very quick. In other parts of the world, they have weeks to decide when they pick this one or when they pick that one. And for us, it all seems to come like right on top of one another. So it's a little bit like it's always a time.
Tell me that you hire people to help.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
I think you could do it. You couldn't do it. It's and that's an important aspect. It's all handpicked around here. Like, and I think in I don't know if how many sort of like machine pickers there are in the Okanagan. I'd be surprised if there were many. For that, you really need large scale, sort of laser guided. You know what I mean? Everything built on a like a computer model, basically.
We don't have to. We don't have to talk about that.
So, handpicked first of all, and then you look at obviously the sugars arrive first. So the sugars you're looking for above everything else. You're looking for ripeness in terms of amount of sugar.
So you pick a grape and check it out with a sugar meter.
What we do is there's different scales, but basically a lot of us use bricks, which is basically roughly a percentage of sugar. So if you're looking at like you're trying to get like around 23, 24 bricks, so 23, 24% sugar. But there's
what does brick stand for?
Bricks. Okay, yeah, you're asking me to go back.
Okay, it's a scale though.
Yeah, in my mind, I've sort of just like. I've distilled it now to basically being like it's roughly the percentage of sugar, a soluble solids in the solution of.
I remind listeners again that I'm talking with Jamie Smith from Marionette Winery, and we're learning about the intricacies of growing and harvesting and processing grapes to make wine.
And then, soluble solids is more specific gravity. So that's another thing that we use. We use that more in the winery, though, when we're watching the sugars go down. So you get sugars first, and then you get what happens is there's an acid. There's a couple of different acids in grapes, and malic acid is the sort of green apple acid. And then that sort of starts to that. The grapes hold that in reserve because it can be quickly transformed into sugar. And at the very end, like as the sugars are accumulating, they start to drop that acid out. They metabolize it. Okay. And so when you see the acids dropping, that's when you have to pick because that happens really quickly. And if you don't do it, you want sort of the perfect balance of sugar and acid. Okay. So you want the acids to drop a little bit. And then with the reds, you're actually there's a third thing that you're wanting to ripen, which is called phenolic ripeness, which is the seeds, because
are rich in phenols.
Yeah, and they're also so they'll basically add tannins. Like when you get like fully ripe seeds, you can eat them like sunflower seeds, like they crunch. You know what I mean? They don't have that bitter. Like mouth drying, like the astringency, right. You can just chew the grape and the seed together, and it's completely brown, like the seed.
So we have now a harvest of grapes, and we have some steps to go before people are going to be drinking wine. They involve preparing the juice, fermentation, bottling, and then, of course, consumption. So let's talk about preparing the juice, because for each of the different kinds of wines you produce, there's a slightly different process here.
Yeah, so whites, everything comes in and gets, we crush and destem. So basically the grapes are removed from the stem and then they're slightly crushed. Not like just enough to release the juice, but not enough to break the
seeds.
And
the device that does that is carefully designed.
It's quite an amazing machine, actually, yeah. I don't know how it works. It just like,
it's magical.
Like a black box. It just does what it does. Like it's like a drum with like these holes in it and then these paddles that go around and they basically the stems go out the back and the grapes go down and get crushed and then they get pumped into the press.
So that's the white wine.
Yeah, and then the reds basically they get crushed and destemmed, but they get you just basically empty them into the vats where they're gonna ferment. And they get fermented skin, seeds, everything together. Yeah.
And these are vats made out of stainless steel?
Yeah. People use different things. I think a lot of us around here use the actual picking bins with reds. Because it doesn't have to be with reds, it doesn't have to be so sterile, you know what I mean? In terms of there's a lot of antioxidants, there's a lot of protection in grape juice because of the phenolic, like phenols are basically very antibacterial, you know what I mean? Antibacterial.
Sure.
So, and phenols, sorry, are the chemical that are in the, like, is basically it like is. Tannins and antioxidants. It's what makes red wine, good for you.
Isn't it extraordinary how complex the constituents of the grape juice and the grapes themselves, the different parts, I mean, de-stemming, one wouldn't think that the stems stay in, but in certain kinds of wine, they are an essential part of the process. And the skins and the seeds, they all have their own special quality. That's the 8,000 years of practice coming into play, it seems to me.
Yeah, and it seems to me like stems are used sometimes to, when we used to buy Riesling for 3 years, we bought Riesling, and it's an amazing grape. I wish we could grow it here, But I think most years we would just fall short of ripeness. And we know that from, we planted 25 vines just to see. But Riesling's one of these grapes where, like, it's one of these grapes where you want, or we used to do it in a way where we wouldn't crush and destem it. We would just put it all, like, whole bunches into the press. When you do whole bunch pressing, that's something they do in Champagne as well. You get very, very good quality juice. But you don't get as much of a yield. Mm. But one thing about throwing the stem or having the stems in there is that you get really good drainage of the juice out of the press because the stems break up the, like, grapes when they're just crushed, they can form this really solid, like, mush inside the press and like
sludge.
Yeah.
It can't be it's impenetrable.
And you have to keep spinning the press to break it up.
Mm.
But the stems actually allow for the juice to come out a lot easier. So that's one use of the stems.
So you've got juice. You've got different juice for red, and rosé is a little bit different from the other two.
Yeah. And rosé you can do in a lot of different ways. Like most rosé in the world, like the rosé you get for, like, I don't know, $11 is probably just red wine and white wine that nobody wanted and was stuck together. Like, literally, like that's mostly what rosé is. But the really, like, quality rosé is, there's a couple of, like, you know, methods for it. The method we use is the Sanier method, where you basically bleed 25% of juice off of the red crush. So, like, you've got your vat filled with red must, they call it, which is the skins, the juice, and the seeds and everything, like, crushed into the vat, ready to ferment. And then after, like, a couple of hours, if you want, like, a light pink rosé, or, like, 8 to 10 hours later, if you want, like a really dark, like, strawberry-colored rosé, you take 25% of the juice away, but you throw the skins back in, and you do that basically with a big, like, sieve. So you're, like, taking the juice, and you watch the vat that was the red crushed grapes, you watch it go down until you get to, like, a certain, like, roughly, you know, like 20%, 25%.
Right.
And then that rosé you put into a tank, a separate tank, stainless steel tank, and then you treat it like a white wine from that point on. You want to preserve it, keep it. It's basically a white wine in terms of its process.
The next phase is the phase where it seems a lot of magical things take place, and that is
fermentation.
The fermentation process. And this is where having a good nose, and I mean like a good sense of smell, is a critical feature. And you've pointed out earlier in our last show that Amanda has this
partner,
very good nose. But the other thing is magical about it is that there are so many different varieties of yeast. I mean, there's yeast that grows on the grapes. Powdery mildew is a fungus, and it grows on. And then there are yeast that ferment the wine, and then there are yeast that sometimes go wonky, and you get a negative outcome very rarely, but after bottling.
Yeah, I think, like, we use natural yeast in the winery, particularly with the reds, and I think that it is a bit, it's strange that we use commercial yeast. It's part of the modern wine industry, and there's nothing wrong with it.
You're talking about the large scale corporate.
Well, I mean,
wine.
I think most wineries, like we've all used commercial yeast. Commercial yeast did start off as wild yeast somewhere in the world. Like,
that's right.
But the thing is that they're like yeast that you buy for your, like, if you're making bread. You know what I mean? You can make sourdough, or you can make bread with like Fleischmann's, you know, yeast, whatever it's called, and then. And in winemaking, it's the same way. You can buy a yeast that was vetted in, like, Geisenheim in Germany and in the institute there. And, it, I mean, that's a fine institute of modern industrial, like, winemaking. You can get Bordeaux-based yeast. California has yeasts, Australia. And they work really well. They are one yeast, though. So basically the idea with those yeasts, because they're called killer yeasts, so they wipe out every other microflora, all bacteria, all other yeasts, all what, like when you crush grapes on your grapes, there are probably 400 to 500 species of natural winemaking yeasts. Now, some of them, they all have different dynamics. Like some of them might only ferment up to 5%, like a beer, basically. Some of them might only go up like to 8%, 9%, and there'll always be one that will finish, like that can go up to 15%. That's basically a winemaking yeast, like the ones that can tolerate 15% alcohol. But when you crush grapes, all of those are going to be in flux, and they'll have this big, like, they'll go to war, basically.
A discussion.
Yeah, and they'll come out, one will come out on top. And you never know what, they'll all contribute flavors and like aspects of the wine that make that wine completely, like you can't reproduce that the next year.
And that's one reason why different years have different qualities.
Yeah, and in the past it did. I think before the modern wine industry is only dates back to about the 1970s. I think that's when like the first like commercial yeasts were made available. And, you know, everything like from then back to like 6,000 years ago, like you were saying, was basically... This year was a, I mean, I think a lot of the culture we have about wine is more from like pre the modern wine industry, where people would be like, wow, that year, that 1967, you know, whatever Aubryon that I had, I remember I was like on this patio with these specific people, and I remember the taste. And like the thing is that is the way it used to be. Like people used to remember where they were, who they were with when they had a wine. And I think with a lot of food and drink, that used to be the way it was before the modern food and beverage industries like have given us things that are this safe. They're good, but they don't give us those memories. Like our sense of smell and taste are supposed to be the things that link us to memory more than any other sense. And our food and drink doesn't do that. Like it's not like we remember. Generic family restaurant and I had steak and I remember exactly how that steak tasted. I remember who I was with. No, we don't think of food that way. When we dine out, we don't think of things like that.
We want uniformity, actually.
Yeah, we want
become
to be
accustomed
safe.
To it.
We want it to be safe. We want it to be reproducible. We want to basically open up a can of Coca-Cola and we don't want to be surprised. We don't want to be like, oh, this is the 1985 Coke? Oh, I hate this. You know, like I like the 1991 Coke. Have you got any of that? No, we don't do that, right? But that's the way we used to be with a lot of things. And wine, like, I don't understand why a lot of people even put the year on the bottle now. You know what I mean? Like, if they're not using natural yeast, you know, because it's such a dynamic difference year to year.
We're coming pretty close to the end of the show, so I want to get a couple of things out for everybody to hear. When you put different wines in the bottle, they've fermented, they've turned into a really acceptable or exceptional particular strain of or type of wine. When they're in the bottle, each wine has a different life. White wine, in brief, does what? You drink it quickly most of the time.
Yeah, white and rosé are meant to be enjoyed almost the year that they're made. The year after, like you bottle them, and then that year, like that they're released.
There are exceptions to that rule, but that's sort of the basic rule.
Yeah, like Riesling's a white wine you can age, but generally speaking, those flavors are transitory. Yeah.
Red wine is the exception.
Red wine, the flavors change. Like the Zweigelt that we're going to release this year, for example, has a very vivid black cherry flavor, which is almost like somebody flavored it with black cherry flavor. That will change. In 5 years from now, it will turn into more like winter spice, sort of that chocolate, you know what I mean? Some, like, it's more Christmassy, I guess. You know what I mean? if I were to use one word. And that's just a natural evolution of those flavor chemicals.
And each of the red wines does that same thing. It goes through this evolutionary process.
Over years,
Over years. Does that make them better or just different?
I think it makes them different. I love young red wines, actually. I think that they have a lot of vibrancy and brightness. But I love the older reds, too. They're really rich and complex, you know what I mean?
It's like all of us.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that.
Except for you, but all us old folks here.
wines are a lot like people, definitely.
They become complex as they age.
Yes.
I think the vibrancy and the richness that we're talking about is very much part of the way you've approached the growing of wine, Jamie. It's been a delight to have you on the show again.
Thank you. It's been great to be here, and thanks for having me twice on the show.
Well, we may have to have you back again when we start to talk about some other intricate aspect of the making of wine. But thank you very much for being with us again, and I'm sure there's going to be listeners who will be trotting out to Marionette Winery and saying, I want one of those. I think that sounded really interesting.
Right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.